It is precisely because questions of race and racism in this country look so different, depending on who is doing the looking, that we need historians, sociologists, ethicists, and theologians alike to bring their expertise to bear on where things stand right now, how we got here, and how can we possibly move forward together. Joel Goza is an author and activist who lived for a decade and a half in poor minority communities in Houston, Texas. His experiences inspired taking on this exceedingly serious and timely topic in his book entitled America's Unholy Ghosts, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics. And I am really pleased that it brings him to State of Belief Radio. Joel, welcome.
Reverend Gaddy, so good to be with you this morning.
There are a lot of way overdue conversations happening these days on the topic of race in this country. What were you not hearing being addressed that you thought should be addressed and you addressed it?
Well, I think one of the things that we have contented ourselves with on conversations of race and religion and some of the issues that we discuss is just looking at what's happening on the surface today and not really understanding where it came from. So one of the things that Martin Luther King Jr. had called us to do is to really begin examining the roots of what he referred to as ideational race hate, to understand where it came from and how it has shaped our understanding of democracy and Christianity in America, knowing that if we only contented ourselves with superficial understandings, we could only develop superficial solutions.
While most people are aware of the key role racial oppression played in the founding of this nation, it gets more complicated when you add religion to the mix. And so how did racist ideas shape American Christianity?
Well, one of the things, you know, that is coming out and being well covered now is the founding racism among our founding fathers, people like Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, James Madison. But one of the things that we often overlook is how to be able to sell the politics of a society of slavery, we had to first convince Christians that this was a good idea. And so before changing and bringing about the type of political revolutions that colonialism and slavery demanded, we actually had to change what we really thought Christianity was all about in order to allow for this type of horrendous work to take place.
And I'm wondering what the overlap is between that and American democracy, because while we worry about the wholesale takeover of parts of our government by religiously motivated sources of a certain skin tone, that's nothing new, right?
Yeah, you know, that fear has always been there, and there for good reason. The world experienced the wars of religion, and they understood what it meant if kings try to take the power of religion and use it to destroy the world. And yet, one of the things that we lost within the mix is a more holistic understanding of religion and politics. And so, you know, in the words of MLK, he phrased it very well. He said that he didn't talk about necessarily the division of religion and politics. What he talked about is how it was the call of religion to always be the conscience of the state and never its tool. And part of what ended up happening on American soils is that as the hearts of white Christians were turned to stone through white supremacy, they were no longer in a place to act as the conscience of the nation. And so, you know, one of the things Frederick Douglass would write continually about is that, you know, when a slave owner became Christian, it only made them more cruel, and that they were a part of a society that was a slave society, to where the sins of our nation were never simply about the sins of individual slave owners. They were the sins of an entire society that was ready to reduce people to property.
Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Adam Smith, in your view, they've got an awful lot to answer for. Isn't that right?
I think they do, you know, and these are the folks that I examine in my book, America's Unholy Ghost. And really what the book is trying to do is to really dissect and analyze what had become kind of political, religious common sense to myself, to understand my own racism. And so the very way that we think about the very nature of politics, the very way we think about the very nature of economics, the very way that we think the nature of religion was in many ways shaped by these three philosophers. And it was shaped in such a way that I could consider myself a good person and yet be very comfortable with racial inequality and the way that racism became institutionalized within the American experiment. You had mentioned in the introduction that I had lived for a long time within inner city communities. And one of the things that became clear to me is that the systems of our city were actually doing precisely the work that they were designed to do. And so we have the horrors that we have of a George Floyd, not because the system is broken, but because the system is doing precisely the type of enforcement that it was designed to do to begin with.
I wish we had a lot more time to cover this historical ground. People will read the book, I hope, and look into that. But I'd like to shift more right now to the present. What does a better understanding of how we got to where we are in terms of race help us know about what we must be doing to go forward?
Right. And so, like, when we look at the crisis that we're facing today in a nation that has racialized poverty, racialized incarceration, by understanding where it came from, we can begin to begin writing a different future. So the next work that I'm writing about it is on the work of reparations. What is it that we're called to do here today to really begin providing a different future? And one of the things that has prevented us from changing is that we have failed to truly question some of the big assumptions that we have made that have led us to the type of crisis that we face today. And what my hope for the book was is that if we can begin questioning some of our big assumptions, then maybe we can begin making, really joining in the fight to make an anti-racist future here in America. But before we can look to the future, we have to deal with the past that is our foundation.
Very early in the book, you say it's time to question our ideologies and to divorce ourselves from racist ideas. Give us an example of what needs to happen. What would that change look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, and so it has to be a whole. White supremacy is a very holistic ideology that has shaped our systems. And one of the things, you know, that I talk about, maybe for just like a very specific example, is we have to begin changing the way that we tell our history. You know, we have to begin to really remember the sins of our past in order to be free from them. There was a reason that we ignored the sins of Thomas Jefferson for as long as we did. And yet our ignoring paid a huge price for that. Following the Civil War, there was a very intentional effort to forget what the war was all about. And it wasn't just in Southern sinners, but it was also in the North. And by forgetting what the war was all about, we began harmonizing our institutions with Jim Crow. Part of what the Reagan Revolution was all about was forgetting the horrors of race that had haunted our nation, the horrors of Vietnam. And so part of what we're fighting for right now is the type of memory that we have to have in order to do the work that we are called to do. It is no coincidence that part of the civil rights movement really picked up following the murder of Emmett Till. Why did it pick up? Because his mom refused to close the casket. on what Mississippi and America had done to her child. And part of the work right now in America is opening the caskets of white supremacy, examining the work that has really happened on black communities, black families, and black people, and begin at that point, once we understand some of the depth of it, to begin crafting an anti-racist future and the type of spiritual, economic, political, educational work that will have to happen in order for us to move the project in a different direction.
Looking at the current electoral situation in Georgia, where the GOP mm-hmm. is trying to tear down the Reverend Raphael Warnock, mm-hmm. I'm obviously not endorsing any candidate, but trying to align him with Jeremiah Wright when he literally preaches in Dr. King's pulpit, I've mm-hmm. got to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, when you think of a Jeremiah Wright, who is a Jeremiah Wright, you know? I mean, he's a veteran that gave his life for, you know, for our nation. And, you know, a lot of things came out on Jeremiah Wright, but the truth was is that a lot of MLK would have harmonized very well with what he said, because who was critiquing Vietnam during that time? It was MLK, calling us the bloodiest nation in the world. And so I don't know, you know, I don't want to create false analogies, but the truth of the matter is that until we can face some of the truths that a Jeremiah Wright has to say, because he's not lying about things, then we are not in the place to do the type of repentance that is necessary to become people that we are called to be. But one of the things that becomes clear in the electoral system in Georgia is that white supremacy, from its very inception, warred against democracy. It warred against including everybody into the democratic experience. And it was the voices of the Warnocks, the Kings, the Jeremiah Wrights that first imagined interracial democracy within America. It was black pulpits that provided that imagination. And it was something that most white people were convinced that would ruin democracy. And so when you look at the Republicans' fight for voter suppression, that has very long legs, you know, that has haunted us, keeping women from the vote, keeping poor folks from the vote. And yet it was precisely the pulpits that Warnock represents that believed that our democracy was strongest when it was most expansive and most inclusionary. And I think that it bears out that they are absolutely right with that.
Joel, I just have to say to you, that is a brilliant answer to that question. And it shows a lot about your ability not only to tell the truth, but to make the truth applicable to where we live. I know you've gotten a lot of articulate interviews since this book came out, and you've had time to take in reader feedback. So what would you say is the key message you hope every reader of this book takes away with them?
One of the things I think that our political imagination has done, and I talk a lot about how this has happened through free market capitalism and a lot of other things, is that it has reduced us to the feeling that we are spectators in what we are witnessing in our nation. And one of the things that MLK tried to do is say, no, we are participants. We are participants. And there is a responsibility that we have in this moment today to fight with everything that we've got for the type of future that we desire. Not all of us are going to go down in history as an MLK, and we don't need to, because the truth of the matter is behind MLK were people in Montgomery, Alabama, who were simply ready to walk rather than to support the racist ways of that city bus. And what has happened throughout America's history is the ability for someone from the African-American tradition, like an MLK, a Frederick Douglass, a W.E.B. Du Bois, to be supported by everyday folks in the fight to humanize our democracy. And so that's what I would hope that people would take away, that we are in a position now where we have to rethink everything. And as scary as that is, to really question what we've been told all of our life, there is a future worth fighting for that makes the process very much worth it, and that makes really leaning into this democratic moment both terrifying but also hopeful. Progress always comes from a time of crisis. And the crisis is terrifying, but it is also an opportunity that we should not fumble at this moment.
Joel Goze is the author of America's Unholy Ghosts, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics. The exorcism you are attempting to perform is equally important for both those who continue to suffer from and those who benefit from these racial issues today. Joel, thank you so much for an illuminating conversation. And the book is a good book for all of us. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Absolutely my honor. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, seriously, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.